I'm Tom DiPietro. That's Ellen Thurston, as
me,
if you could
that's
see.
That's
me. Co-host Ellen Thurston.
Hi.
And our guest has arrived, Tamar Adler. And this is exciting to us because we've been reading her books.
And we're both hungry as a result.
Yes, they were hard to read because they make you very hungry. Her new book coming out, is it out officially yet? You got to get right up to the mic in this place.
It's officially out last week.
Oh, great. It's called Something Old, Something New, Classic Recipes Revised. And late last night, I finished her first book, Everlasting Meal, also published by Scribner's and available in paperback. Yes. Did they just reissue that in conjunction with the new book?
No, it's been, they do pretty regular printings, luckily.
Do they print on demand?
No.
They don't print on demand, but luckily that book has found an audience. And so it's, I don't know what printing it is on now, but it does, they do keep on making more.
So
paperback.
The most exciting aspect of this interview, as Ellen can confirm, is that Tamar is a new, well, relatively new resident of Hudson, New York, our little burg.
That's right.
Which is, you know, we've always thought of it as a food-centric community. And now we have a food guru, a food whisperer.
Am I the food whisperer?
Yeah, you're the. Yeah, I mean we've had you know pretenders, lots of pretenders.
I'm the real deal.
Well, yeah, Everlasting Meal in particular is really to me. I mean, it's like a philosophy of food. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I hope that's what it is. It certainly came out of my kitchen, my thinking about cooking, my thinking about food, and it's sort of. I didn't know if I'd be able to write another book about cooking because I'd sort of said everything that I had thought up until that point.
Yeah,
first book.
It gave me the feeling that maybe I really could cook.
that's so great. That's what I intended to do. You can.
Well, I do because I have to, but I don't like cooking. But recently I find before your book, but this gave me more heart to move forward, that I was throwing away much too much food. I'd go to the farmer's market on Saturday and see all this wonderful stuff and take it home. And then at the end of the week, end up throwing it away. And I vowed that I was going to try to use everything up.
Which is the philosophy of the book.
Yeah.
Use everything.
It turns out that's the philosophy
really
of the book.
Yeah,
it's just that we don't really have a good sense of what to do with all those extras and leftover items when we cut up stuff and cook stuff and don't know how to reuse it. Or near the end, you learn how to, if you screw something up, how to fix it or how to use it in another way. It's just an amazing book. I really love the book.
Thank you.
For the new book, so we got to
talk about both.
Okay.
I mean, I think that one of the things that I realized I could do in a second book was apply my philosophy of cooking to other dishes. I mean, the first book, as you both know, having just kindly read it, is really about, you know, just day in, day out, making everyday food with whatever ingredients you have, whatever money you have. It's really not about, you know, there are a few recipes in there that, you know, are explicitly for sort of special events. I think there's a pork cooked in milk that I say, like, this is a great dinner party dish. But most of it's just about feeding yourself.
Right.
And so I, with Something Old, Something New, it occurred to me that it might be helpful to have somebody, me in this case, explain how you can use, you know, kind of this foundational philosophy of saving things, you know, using what you have, et cetera, for slightly fancier food, and,
right,
you know, or just a different kind that you can go on cooking this way, even if you want to cook things other than beans and broccoli stalks, which are kind of the foundations of.
And some of the recipes that, I mean, part of it is rescuing recipes that are sort of out of style for various reasons.
Yeah.
You know, because maybe too much cream was used in it conventionally or too much butter, or just how to reshape them, given, you know, more the what we think about food these days.
Well, the first thing I read of yours was the Grub Street article. And I thought, I ended up saying, my God, I eat the same way. It's called grazing, isn't it? Or, you know, you were wandering around in the morning and sort of eating a little bit of this.
Explain what that was. That was a column in New York Magazine.
Yes, we should. Yes.
And we're talking to Tamar Adler, the author of the new book, Something Old, Something New, from Scribner's. And that's Ellen Thurston asking her a question.
Well, sort of grazing is kind of what I do most of the time. I mean, and it ends up being a whole meal.
Yeah.
But I don't eat it all, you know, on the same plate at the same time.
Yeah, bits and bobs.
My question about that Grub Street article was, were those apricots, by any chance, Tierra Farm apricots? Dried apricots?
Where were the dry? I don't know. I have no idea where they were.
Because I have the same problem. I did have the same problem.
You realize you've eaten about a bushel of apricots?
Yeah, right. And it's like, this is not really doing what I'm hoping to do, which is get away from sweet, you know, other kinds of processed sweets. I'm eating a whole...
I think in that article, I probably ate a bushel of apricots.
Well, the other thing that I was inspired to do because of the Grub Street article, partially, is that I don't know why, but we both, Tom and I, vowed that we weren't going to eat processed sugar anymore, or try not to. And I love chocolate. I have a hard time with chocolate. So when I get the urge now for chocolate, I eat a clementine instead.
How's it working?
It works pretty well because they are so delicious, the little clementines.
Yeah.
But it should be pointed out that Tamar is not a kind of, I mean, you're health aware, but it's not kind of like a repressive menu of, you know, avoiding things. This is really more about common sense. That's what really seems so great about Everlasting Meals. It's just a very common sense view of food. And I noticed you thank Michael Pollan at the end, among other people. And, you know, it seems to reflect a lot of his policies. You're not a vegetarian, though. And
I'm not a vegetarian.
You're right.
I eat heartily and widely.
I guess one of the questions that a lot of people will wonder, our listeners will wonder, you know, we have a lot of listeners. Just want you to know. We're the highest rated program in Hudson.
Downtown Hudson.
Who told you?
I made that up, Ellen. You know I make up stuff.
Oh, sorry. I interfered.
How did you become... Well, you also, I should mention, are a regular contributor to Vogue magazine on food. What's the profile of a food writer? Did you have writing aspirations first and happen to know a lot about food? Or how did you get here?
I flip-flopped and was lucky to kind of land in the middle or be allowed to continue to flip and flop. Mm-hmm. I always wrote, you know, when I was little, I think it was something that I enjoyed doing, but I never would have said that I wanted to be a writer because that didn't seem like a reasonable thing to want to be. But I became a magazine editor pretty immediately after college. I was an editor at Harper's Magazine.
Oh. Do you know Margaret Cordy?
Yes.
That's my cousin's wife.
No way.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So Margaret was one of the first people that I worked for there.
Oh.
I'll have to small tell world.
Very.
Yeah,
very.
It's a small world after all. Yeah. You don't know our show, but I like to, whenever the moment comes up, I like to sing.
How do you know I'm not one of your thousands and thousands of listeners?
Oh, okay. That's possible.
We'll put you on the list.
We'll put you on the list.
You're number 38.
Sit on a post-it note.
So you were an editor at Harper's.
I was an editor at Harper's, and while I was there, I found myself becoming really interested in food and cooking. And there's a farmer's market at Union Square Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. And I often would work Saturday or Sunday because I was, you know, 23 and aspiring and really wanting to move up the ladder. But I spent probably an hour every day that there was a farmer's market at the farmer's market and became known in the office for giving restaurant recommendations, handing out recipes, cooking things and bringing them into the office. And this was all at the very beginning of my interest in food.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very deep and kind of immersive interest. And I ended up asking Gabrielle Hamilton at Prune Restaurant if there's any way she would let me kind of moonlight in her kitchen. And after some protracted negotiation, she said no. And then I ended up doing
it
anyway.
No,
I told her I was pretty dead set on it, and I showed up. And she was a wonderful teacher and let me cook there on Saturdays. So nobody at Harper's knew that I was cooking. Mm. It was my secret. And I lived in terror that somebody from work was going to walk into the restaurant. Mm. But eventually it was exhausting. I felt like I wasn't doing as well at work. I felt like I wasn't doing as well at cooking, as I could be in both senses. And so I told Gabrielle I was going to go back to the publishing world, and I stopped working there. And I think 3 or 4 months later, I quit Harper's because I wanted to cook.
And is that when you went to Atlanta?
I spent a year working for Dan Barber of Blue Hill at Stone Barns. Mm-hmm. I was actually his research assistant. Yeah. I didn't cook there.
You get that, Ellen? Chefs now have research assistants. Pretty cool, huh?
Really?
Have you been to Stone Barns?
Was this
Ellen?
A restaurant? No, where?
Oh, it's amazing. It's in Tarrytown.
In Tarrytown Hills.
Yeah.
It's incredible, and its founder and executive chef is Dan Barber, mm-hmm. who is a really brilliant thinker about food and agriculture, and always about 10 steps ahead of what anybody else is thinking about or talking about. He has a book out, came out a few years ago, called Third Plate. That's a really interesting...
Sounds like a baseball.
I know. I know. But it's a really beautiful look at agriculture and mm-hmm. ways that we're not generally thinking about it right now, but need to be. But in any case, I was his research assistant and I was a personal chef for a year, and I took the LSAT got accepted to some very great law schools and deferred to go help my friends in Georgia, and eventually did not go. I promised both. I deferred from 2 schools, which you're not allowed to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to sign something saying that you're not doing that, but I did it. And I deferred from Michigan and Georgetown. And then I think one of them I even paid, like, you know, some initial fee. And then I just became a cook.
Reading Everlasting Meal, it also becomes clear that your family, I mean, there's a lot of food consciousness at home.
Yes.
And your brother apparently is
my
a chef.
My brother's a chef.
Where, is your chef in New York now?
Right now is the culinary director of Blue Apron.
Oh.
He was the chef of Franny's in Brooklyn for mm-hmm. a very long time. Before that, he was at Per Se.
Oh.
And Thomas Keller's restaurant. Yeah. Before that, he was at Blue Hill at Stone Barns.
Blue Apron one of those
boxes?
Yeah. Boxes.
Yeah.
Tempting.
But they're actually delicious.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's funny because, you know, you guys have just read An Everlasting Meal.
Right,
it's sort of
like
the opposite of my entire, you know, philosophy is based on the idea that you have to buy the whole thing. Otherwise, how will you have all of these ingredients mm-hmm. to make all of these meals? What will you do without, you know, you have to kind of reframe the head of broccoli as, you know, the stem is good for something, the leaves are good for something, and then the crown is good for something. And of course, you know, with Blue Apron, you tend not to get the stem and the leaves, but they seem like opposites. They're similar in that both of us want people cooking at home. It's just different.
Right.
I think there is probably room for as many approaches as there are approaches.
So we're talking to Tamar Adler, the author of the new book, Something Old, Something New, Classic Recipes Revised. She's also written Everlasting Meal. You know, reading Everlasting Meal, one of the first things, and you actually ended up addressing it, I kept thinking, what does her refrigerator look like? Because if she's saving all these things, it must be...
it's impossible.
And
it's
then you said you really have a hard time keeping track.
This one is orange rind.
I know, right?
Yeah. It's absolutely impossible. And my husband mandates regular purges. But they're not... I don't actually purge. What I do is I make stock. Or he makes stock. One of us just throws all of the, you know, all the bones and all of the stems into a pot. And then because I can't throw, I am constitutionally unable to throw anything out. I can't do it. The purges actually just consist of like consolidating various, mm-hmm. if there are a lot of jars that have some, you know, shallots sitting in a little vinegar, I put them all in one and then, I label the other ones. If it's labeled, then he doesn't feel like it's going to attack me.
So when you make a lot of stock, that's another thing. I always try to make stock, and then I just, like, don't use it all. I guess you can freeze it, right?
You freeze it, yeah.
We so have, do you have a full-size freezer for everything?
We have a chest freezer in our carriage house. Yeah, and it was interesting to work on something old, something new with my culinary philosophy, because it is really drawing from cuisines of the past and cuisines in which there was a very sort of narrow, you know, pantry that you were drawing from. So pretty much, you know, the vegetable for most of the main courses was mushroom. You know, that it was like mushroom, cream, butter, very like nothing green and very little flexibility with regard to, you know, what you could use. It wasn't about using what you had. It was like going out and getting this particular thing, and it had to be made this particular way. And so it was a unique challenge to try to work on recipes that are actually very strict, very orthodox, very narrow in scope with, you know, the way I naturally cook, which is all about flexibility and using what you have.
Did you particularly sort of narrow it down to a list of, like, famous? I know Peach Melba, for example. Like, did you go right for the biggies?
No, I didn't. I some things I knew I wanted. I'm opening the book now, so I can. I mean, I knew that I wanted to have Steak Diane in it, and I knew I wanted to have Potage Esau and watercress soup.
I remember all these because, you know, being older, you know, this was fine dining,
right?
In the 60s, and when
and
I was
they're
young.
Just things you don't see on menus, and you certainly don't cook. And I knew I wanted a shrimp pate, and Oysters Rockefeller and Clams Casino, and I knew I wanted Peach Melba. I knew I wanted Charlotte Russe. There were things that mostly the reason I wanted to include them was because I had never tasted them. They were beautiful.
Yeah.
They were beautiful names of dishes, and right. I loved reading the names, and I loved reading the stories they were in, and I loved reading them on menus.
Right, and if you read a lot of the classic food writers, which you clearly have, you know, whether it's M.F.K. Fisher or A.J. Liebling or any of these people, you always see that. I mean, he's always writing about Charlotte Russe and
and so Peach I wanted Mama. To taste them.
Yeah, right.
And I would sometimes, you know, make them according to an old recipe and find them absolutely horrid. And so part of the reason I wrote the book was because I wanted to taste things that I'd read about. Mm-hmm. Part of it was because I would read old recipes, because I love reading old recipes, and find something in them that I knew was culinarily smart and needed to survive, but couldn't, surrounded by the rest of it. You know, there would be something and I would think, oh, that would be so delicious, but the rest of it has to be changed. It can't be made like that. It won't be to our taste now. I'm sure it was to the tastes of, you know, whomever was eating it.
In some cases, was it just a question of ingredients that are just, you know, not pleasant anymore? You know what I mean? Something fake or...
Sometimes it was stuff like lots of Ritz cracker crumbs and things. Yeah. Canned mushrooms, cracker crumbs.
Right.
There's a story that goes around Hudson about the famous canopy that the social star of Hudson used to serve some woman whose name we have forgotten.
Oh, come on, tell us.
It was Ritz crackers and, I'm going to get it wrong, I think. Peanut butter and mustard.
No.
Yeah, peanut butter and then a dollop of mustard.
No.
And
when was this?
It was apparently delicious.
Really?
It was quite some time ago. But
I can't believe you didn't bring them in for an on-air tasting.
No, there was no WGXC then. So.
No, I mean today.
Oh, today. I should have.
I think we
should try it.
Yeah. I think it is upon you both to do an on-air sampling of
Ritz crackers with peanut butter and mustard, a dollop of mustard.
Dollop of mustard.
Not to
listen.
Was it French's?
Well,
I
asked that. Was it yellow mustard? Yeah. Was it grainy? Yeah. You know,
no way.
And it must have been creamy peanut butter, you know, with sugar. Yeah. Like Skippy.
Oh, God. Yeah.
It sounds it sounds disgusting.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to try it, but it sounds horrible.
Well, there's nothing disgusting in Something Old, Something New, Tamar Adler's new book, and we're talking to her right now. I'm Tom DiPietro. Ellen Thurston is across the table, as always.
That's
with
me.
With a freshly coiffed do.
Not once you put headphones on, you have a headphone here.
But I know no one can see, so I just, you know, we'll play. We'll pretend.
Speaking of things that don't sound like they're good but are good,
mm-hmm.
I visited some friends in Cape May once, and he said, I'm going to bring these special hot dogs. We're going to have these special hot dogs for lunch, and you can fix it any way you want. And he fixed his by putting, you know, a grilled mm-hmm. dog, and mm-hmm. they were very good, really good, high quality. Peanut butter and chopped raw onion.
Wow.
Delicious.
Really?
Yes.
I think you just like anything that's peanut butter.
That's what I was about to say. I wonder if the lesson isn't that peanut butter is good.
Well,
I've never had something with peanut butter that I didn't like, so it might just be, it might be impossible to make something bad with peanut butter.
Do you make your own peanut butter? I mean, do you grind raw peanuts?
No.
Or
do you?
No.
No.
I buy Smucker's, the one that has no sugar, no salt, no nothing.
Just peanuts.
Yeah.
Just
peanuts. And it's really good. Okay. And the oil rises to the top.
Ellen Thurston recommends Smucker's peanuts. Too bad we're not advertising, you know? We could make some money. Or at least get some free peanut butter.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to say is that I had a friend from Germany who said about Americans and the way they handled food, said every kitchen I go into, there's a cold roast chicken in the refrigerator. Oh, we have a little chicken. We can have that for lunch. And
that sounds like a great thing.
Yeah.
It is a great thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've never heard anyone say that. But
that's what Americans actually do.
Really?
They roast a chicken, they have it on hand.
Okay.
And
where I grew up, it was always, you know, there was sauce on the stove.
Right.
Red sauce.
Red sauce.
You remember? Remember I'm Italian-American? You remember that?
Yeah, I know.
Was it a full day red sauce?
Actually, it was only one day a week. My great aunts were like that, though. They had the, you know, constantly going. And you go over their house. They're my father's aunts, so they're my great aunts. And they had the second kitchen in the basement, the whole classic thing, you know. And constantly, there's just, and they wouldn't let you go without eating. Oh, my God, it was but it was great food. And, of course, you know, that's the funny thing about the philosophy in An Everlasting Meal. A lot of people followed those views out of necessity in the past.
Of course.
You know? I mean, nobody wasted anything.
I mean, yeah, right. The epigraph of Something Old, Something New is from the Bible. And I think if I had found it when I was writing An Everlasting Meal, I might have used it for mm-hmm. that, because it is... Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. And it certainly applies to, you know, old recipes that you're kind of burnishing. But it also applies to anything I've ever written about food. I mean, I did not invent anything mm-hmm. in An Everlasting Meal. It's just the way people have always cooked and then forgot.
Right.
Which I think in a lot of ways, the two books are very similar.
Mm-hmm.
They're both just about things I don't want to be forgotten. And so they're kind of rescue missions.
My wife has tried to make some of those dishes that, in Something Old, Something New, in the conventional way, you know, from old cookbooks. And I always wonder, because you know what happens is, if it requires something odd, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but then we go into the pantry and there's like two or three of that item.
Just sitting there
and it just sits there forever. And it's just like, what is that?
Yeah.
<You know>?
Yeah. No, I know. I think, there's a lot of that with recipes in general. And it's one of the reasons I discourage buying things, especially for recipes. I mean, I think there are a few more things like that in Something Old, Something New. For instance, there's gelatin in a few recipes. And mm-hmm. in one that my book agent objected to, I actually used Sichuan peppercorns, which I never would have done in An Everlasting Meal, but Something Old, Something New is more of a recipe book.
Mm-hmm.
And also, so many people buy you know, more exotic or so many people now actually cook in a way that Sichuan peppercorns would be kind of more welcome in and kind of used on a regular basis.
Yeah. I
mean, you know, you also can order them on Amazon and they arrive the next day, and then, you know, 10 recipes in the New York Times that day have Sichuan peppercorns in them. And it's just, it's there. So there are certain, when I did use an ingredient that I didn't think you would just have sitting around, it was only because it's one that I've seen popping up again and again and again, and it seemed like it might actually be useful to have around.
I know Ellen will want to know the answer to this question. Now that you live in Hudson, what do you think of the food scene here? Is it, are you encouraged that you can sort of do the kind of, you can access, I mean, it's pretty amazing, right?
It's amazing.
What you can get here.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It's wonderful.
I mean, a little city in the middle of nowhere, sort of.
Yeah, and I'm still figuring out where I get each thing. I mean, I don't, like, my system isn't fully worked out, but I really like it taking a long time to get my system worked out. This winter, we were members of the Sparrowbush Winter CSA for the first time, which is incredible. And I would think
that you, of all people, could maximize the use of a CSA. I mean, the last time I did it, just like Ellen, I had too many things I didn't use because my wife only is here on the weekends, and it was like, it's just too much. And then I was reading Everlasting Miller, I could have eaten all those eggs. I just didn't think of enough imaginative ways to use them, you know?
My new challenge, which I think I have been presented with probably because I felt smug about the fact that I'm the best CSA member ever. You know, I can really make the most of a CSA share. So my challenge to that smugness has come in the form of my son, who...
I was going to ask you about that. Go ahead.
He, so far, has shown absolute indifference, verging on real distaste for... Indifference to distaste for roasted vegetables. So one of the things that I have always...
I know, a lot
done.
Of
lots of vegetable roasting. Yeah. But it's delicious. Vegetable roast.
I mean, I agree.
You know,
we've been doing
pack
that.
Pack your oven full of vegetables.
Do it all the time.
A lot of salt, a lot of oil.
Yeah.
They're great. They're a snack.
I know.
And he won't eat them. So it's trying to...
How old is he now?
He is 20 months.
20 months. Okay.
Today. So my new challenge is using everything from my CSA, using all the parts of it, and cooking it in a way that he will abide, that he will give his imprimatur to in the form of actually ingesting.
Yeah, I didn't have that problem with my daughter because I did most of the cooking when she was growing up. And I'm very proud of the fact that she was eating broccoli rabe when she was that age.
Yeah.
And I was like, how did she? I got her to like bitter stuff. I didn't like bitter stuff till I was a grown up.
I think it's them. Weirdly, though, Lewis likes broccoli rabe. That's one thing that he won't eat broccoli, but he'll eat broccoli rabe. I think it must be in them. I keep on offering him stuff, and I don't make a big deal when he doesn't eat it. I'm following all the rules of how to not pathologize or, like, you know, make what might just be a sort of adaptive stage.
Into
something
deal,
bigger.
That he has to go to a psychiatrist for.
Right, eventually.
They forced me to eat fancy food. I didn't want it. I just wanted chicken McNuggets. I never let my daughter. I think my wife let her have them occasionally. But I was the moment I ate my first one way, way back when and realized it wasn't even a real piece of chicken.
That
it was just reconstituted chicken. I was like, are you kidding me? Anyway. It really disgusts
me. Yeah, no, he's never... He does... I mean, I have noticed that I fry a lot more than I used to. But I like fried food, so that's not terrible. I finally had one of my greatest successes two nights ago with tempura. Tempura worked.
Because with vegetables,
You have to be a crazy person to not like tempura-battered fried vegetables. You could... I've never met that person.
Once again, we're talking to Tamar Adler, author of Something Old, Something New, previously The Everlasting Meal, the food writer for Vogue, and most exciting of all, a Hudson resident.
That's right.
Isn't that exciting?
How did you find Hudson? I mean, it's easy to find.
It's not a map.
I mean, that's true.
They don't keep it off the map.
But what was the impetus to come here?
Well, I think I drove through it when I was coming to a wedding once, and I thought, oh, this town's really cool. And then... I had, I think a lot of people have a story like the one I'm about to tell about Hudson, but it was a beautiful October day, and I was driving up to a flower farm called Saipua. Maybe their farm is called End of the World Farm, about an hour north of here. And the people I was driving with were tasked with picking up cheese at Talbot and Arding. And I'm friends with Mona and Kate from years ago. And I was excited to see them.
You and Mona both worked
for... We both worked at Chez Panisse, yeah. And we pulled into town at this glorious, you know, it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The trees were on fire. The light was perfect. Talbot and Arding was the most lovely store I'd ever been in.
It just gets better.
Yeah, it does just get better. Yes, yeah. We encountered Earl for the first time. We went into Antigo. We found Back Bar and had some midday rosé. We went into Spotty Dog and went, this is the coolest bookstore. I can't believe we can sit here. We might have had a beer there, too. I mean, we really kind
so
of
you had
milked
the,
Warren Street.
Yep. The Hudson experience.
We and all three of us fell in love with it. And then we had to continue on our way to this dinner we were going to. We showed up hours late because we had spent so much time in Hudson. The cheese course was long over. But I came home saying, I should really live there. And kind of got this bee in my bonnet, just feeling like that's a great place. That's a good place to live. And maybe 2 weeks later, I dragged my husband back up here. We stayed with Kate and Mona and had another just really, you know, that October here is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And we woke up in their house and it was silent. And we were living in Gowanus, Brooklyn. And we, I don't know, we went to Farmer and Sons. Yeah. And we just sort of, and we tried to buy a house that weekend. We literally tried to buy a house out of a window on Warren Street.
Well, that's amazing. We Ellen and I are visionaries. Of course, Ellen more so than I, since she came here, what, 25 years ago?
24.
24.
To be precise.
She saw the future.
You did.
Yes.
No, I didn't really. I mean, the future was already here. I mean, it was beginning.
It was happening.
It was beginning.
But there's more the antique phase then.
Well, yeah, there were something like 65, no, 35 yeah. antique stores.
Wow. And how many of them are still here?
I don't know. I should
know
count.
Number.
It'd be interesting.
But a lot of them, you know, have migrated to the L&B building.
Right.
So it's not too many of them just, you know, picked up and gave up.
Right, right.
So they're
right,
still
right.
in business, a lot of them, even though they're not on Warren Street because the Warren Street prices go through the roof.
And we do have good antiques here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's I mean, and in the earlier days before Stair Galleries went online, those auctions were like, wow, you could get stuff for nothing. You know, I mean, really.
Really?
You could furnish your house. We've looked in our house and looked at all the furniture and said, everything here has come from an auction at Stair. In the days, now it's online, so people anywhere can bid. But
so is it
days,
expensive now?
Not expensive. There's still things that don't go, and you can get less, you know.
They put them in an exposition.
Exposition auction. Yeah, those are the ones
they go
to.
Do on Fridays.
But in the old days, the expedition auctions were like, man, you get couches for $100. I mean, really nice things for very cheap. Anyway, that's how it used to be.
Yeah.
I hate to be one of those people, though. That's how it used to be. I unlike Ellen, I love every change in Hudson. Is that true, Ellen?
I have no idea what you're talking about. No.
Well, I deferred.
Well, I'm going to change the subject.
Okay, I will say, one of the things that really got exciting about, I would say it was about 8 years ago or so, is when there was an influx of young people. I mean, people in their 20s who were just like coming here to make music, make art, and hang out, and it's like, this is pretty cool. It's not just a bunch of us old timers who are sick of the city or whatever.
We're old timers already. Yeah.
But you've proven that you can do it. So we're talking to Mara Adler, author of Something Old, Something New, and An Everlasting Meal, food writer for Vogue. What are you working on for your next Vogue article? Can you tell us?
Wow. You know, I'm probably not supposed to.
Oh,
I'm glad that you asked me whether I could, because I was probably just about to say something I wasn't supposed to say.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. How about, what was the last one about?
That I can do.
Since I don't read Vogue. Ellen, of course. Do you read Vogue, Ellen?
No, I don't.
Oh. Vogue's great.
I interviewed Joan Juliet Buck here.
Oh, does she live close by?
She lives in Rhinebeck, I think, or Rhinecliff, one of those.
She probably doesn't write for them anymore.
No, right? No.
There was a scandal.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That was before my time, but yeah. I know about the scandal. Not from there. I think I remember reading about it.
Yeah.
What was my last article about? I wrote a piece on Chinese food. That was really fun to report. I wrote an unpublished piece, so I can't talk about that one. Before that, I wrote about alternative milks, which was very interesting.
I mean, like other animal milks or raw milk or all those things?
The whole wide and woolly world of milks that do not come from a cow. So from nuts, from seeds, from other animals. I had a milk tasting, which involved, I don't even remember, but I think 37 different milks.
I hate
saying the word milk.
Yeah, I didn't drink milk as a child. I hate milk. Have you met, what's her name, Elaine Kosrova?
No.
She wrote a book called Butter.
Oh, I remember seeing it in Mona's.
Yeah, she's from up here. And
pretty interesting.
We interviewed her. It's a really good book because she reported as well as just, you know, wrote about butter. She, you know, had yak butter in a mountain in Nepal and that kind of thing, you know, and it was really quite an exciting book.
I should read it.
Yeah, it was good. Anyway, do you have a big publicity tour coming up for this?
I have a small publicity tour, which I think hopefully will sort of get bigger in a slow, organic way, because I didn't want to be away for a very long time.
Right, because of the baby.
So we actually, I had a launch party last night in Brooklyn, which has left me a little bit blurry. We were out till 1:30. It was a great party though. And then we fly out to California on Wednesday. The whole family's going to go. And I have an event at Scribe Winery in Sonoma. And then two events at the Ferry Plaza, which is where there's a farmer's market.
Are you from the West Coast? Or?
No, I'm from New York, but I cooked out there for about 2 years. So I still have a community out there.
Mm-hmm.
Then I come back here, and on April 23rd, there is a dinner drawn from this book at Gaskin's in Germantown, which will be really fun. There's a beautiful, beautiful menu. I saw early versions of it had deviled eggs and filet mignon on toast and chicken Kiev.
Is it sold out already?
I don't know.
Oh.
I don't know. But it's going to be great.
Cool.
Because it's not a set menu. They're doing an a la carte menu. Mm-hmm. They're just the whole menu is going to be from the book.
That's funny. That's great.
And then on May 5th, I'm going to do a signing at Talbot and Arding along with meringues. And in the book, there's a recipe for vin d'orange, which is this wonderful French fortified wine that my husband and I make every year.
I remember the days of fortified wine.
It's
remember
really
those,
good.
Ellen? Remember when I still drank? Those were the days. God, I wish I could.
She doesn't miss those days.
She doesn't
sound
at all.
Like.
No.
She doesn't look like she misses
no.
them.
No.
No, I don't.
I was a carouser. I only gave up 2 years ago.
Congratulations.
Well, it's just, you know, I had to. But yeah, I miss wine most of all.
Yes.
And
I
liked fortified wines. I liked ports. All those kind of things.
I drink sherry. Is that a fortified wine?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
There you go.
Great.
Of course you drink sherry. Look at you. You drink sherry. You're obviously a sherry drinker. How much, though?
Do you mean because she's
just
a lady?
Just a little
yes.
bit.
Yeah.
Just a wee bit of sherry.
My grandmother drinks amaretto.
Really?
And I keep trying to get her to move to sherry because I love sherry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I would love to sit and have a glass of sherry with her, but I cannot have a glass of amaretto.
It's just so like, goopy and thick.
I think there are like three things that I dislike to ingest, and amaretto is one of them. Sambuca is probably the other one.
Yeah, I was young, I liked Sambuca because whatever. But then when you have real sort of quality Sambucas, you know, that are thin and more, you know, then you think, why did I ever drink that sugary junk that gave me headaches?
It gives
and
me
sick.
Shivers.
Yeah, it's really horrible.
Yeah.
Could I shift to back to vegetables?
Let's shift to zucchini.
I'm curious about zucchini because my father always had a huge garden because we lived in this little village that allowed room for that.
You're talking the little village of Kirkwood outside of Binghamton?
Yes, I am. And we had all kinds of squash, but we never had zucchini that I knew of as a child, because it didn't exist.
And I
think your book makes reference at one point to the fact that it was called the Italian squash at one time.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's why you didn't eat it. Yeah, I know you, Ellen.
You're talking
about that one Italian family in your neighborhood.
Okay,
yeah,
Tom.
You were friends with them.
I don't think he planted broccoli either. I don't think we knew about broccoli.
No vegetables with a vowel at the end.
That could be. That could be. Who knows? But I don't know when all that changed. I was just curious.
Well, it's in the 60s. The 60s is when it changed. I mean, Craig Claiborne was a big player in bringing what were then exotic vegetables to the American garden.
And they were exotic, and then suddenly they were so prolific that you had to get them away.
They were so prolific, but what I liked about Everlasting Meal was it points out that a lot of people were, you know, just like raw. They just like vegetables for the sake of vegetables, and they didn't do anything with them. You know, they didn't put any kind of flavoring or sauce.
Right.
And of course, my favorite statement in the entire book is when you say that, you know, the key things you need are anchovies, capers, olives, because those are the things that are a staple.
Yeah,
in my
if you have
pantry.
Those,
I mean,
you're fine.
Garlic,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I wrote I was a columnist for the Times Magazine until a few months before Lewis was born. And then I just decided that I had the book and I have about 6 or 7 pieces a year for Vogue, and I was writing a monthly column for the Times, and I thought I didn't know when I was going to be able to actually mother my child, so I had to drop something, and I dropped the Times. But I wrote one of my columns for the Times was about that trio of anchovies, capers, and olives as the most powerful things in your kitchen, and that if you have them, you can do anything. You don't need, you know, that's it.
Yeah. And I love throughout the book that you're constantly just drizzling oil, olive oil. Because you know, Ellen, that's how I roll. I drizzle olive oil on everything.
Right.
And that was a big, and something
old,
something new.
Ice cream recently.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I've had it too. It's great on panna cotta also.
Yeah.
Really delicious. You know, just using olive oil in some of the old recipes was a significant and much needed change.
Because what would they use? Just
butter.
Oh, butter, yeah.
What kind of olive oil do you
use? California Olive Ranch olive oil.
That square bottle?
The square bottle.
I use that, too.
Yeah, I think that
somebody, maybe it was in the Times, that suddenly California olive oil was the one to have.
Yes. Well, you know, there's been this mosca, it's called, a little fly, has been destroying olive trees in Tuscany for the last 3 years or so, which has resulted in prices going through the roof. And a lot of places that used to make their own olive oil now only make it with their consortio, their whole little community. Mm-hmm. So quality is much more variable. Prices are very high.
And a lot more is coming from Sicily and Sardinia and Spain and Greece.
Yeah,
you know,
and
not,
so it's not as well regulated.
Right.
And California's doing a great job with oil.
I seem to use a lot of olive oil. Seems to go rapidly.
Yeah, me too.
Me three.
It keeps
you three.
First time I ever had eggs cooked in olive oil was when I was a teenager living with a family in Spain, and I was like, oh, my God. And then I realized it was fantastic.
The best thing.
It was the greatest thing.
Yeah.
It never changed.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever cooked eggs in butter since then.
Yeah, I don't.
Oh, I do.
They're good. But olive oil also has a higher smoke point than butter.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be. It's not as finicky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now our taste buds are enlivened after talking to Tamar Adler, author of the new book, Something Old, Something New. Classic recipes
revised.
And also author available in paperback, or I wouldn't mention it, An Everlasting Meal. So I'm sure you're probably thinking of the next book already.
Actually, I sold 2 books at once when I sold Something Old, Something New. So I know what the next one is, and I even plugged it at my book party last night.
Okay.
My editor was very proud of me. It's called, I mean, the title might change, but it's called What to Do with the Cold Chicken.
Ah.
Speaking of.
That's right. Everyone needs a cold chicken.
Everyone needs a cold chicken. There used to be regularly published books that were just about what to do with leftovers. And there was an American one that was called What to Do with a Cold Mutton. So this is going to be 100%, I know, 100% recipes, no narrative, A to Z recipe guide. And I don't ever want it to come out in hardcover. I want it to just be softcover, flimsy paper, as light and cheap and thick as possible. Sort of like the, you know, the Fanny Farmer, that you can get, you know, these little books that you can just keep in your kitchen. They cost, you know, whatever, $4 at Target or something like that. I want this to be absolutely, you know, in every single kitchen and available to everybody. And it's just going to be, you know, the principles that I lay out in An Everlasting Meal, but a guide. So you can just open it up and go, okay, I have one cup of applesauce. What the heck do I do?
Great.
So that is, that's my next one.
Here's maybe a final question, unless Ellen has one. How do you, and I'm sure a lot of people want to know.
I've got a lot of questions.
How do you
still
balance being a relatively new mother? This is your first child, right?
This is my first child.
A new mother, a full-time, basically a full-time writing life. I mean, is it hard scheduling the writing, the mothering, the wifing?
It's, if I'm doing a good job focusing, it's not, because Lewis goes to daycare and loves it. I have to get home to him very shortly, though. when I was under deadline for Something Old, Something New, it was very hard. And my husband didn't work out of the house for the first year of Lewis's life, which is what made the book possible. And that whole, I mean, when I was to be writing Vogue pieces and finishing a book was really hard. He was really what allowed that to happen.
Okay, well, we're getting to the top of the hour, so we can let you go. And we have to play the news.
And you have to come back again.
I would love to come back.
There's lots more to talk about. Like, why didn't you put in the... There was a clam chowder
debate.
Controversy between New England and New York style.
Yeah.
And
I'm an avid supporter of New England.
I am too.
Yeah. And so there's not a Manhattan in there because I just don't like it.
Good.
There you go.
There
Ellen.
You go.
All right.
So, folks, once again, we've been talking to Tamar Adler, author of Something Old, Something New, and An Everlasting Meal, both in print. Something Old, Something New is freshly in print. And she's a Hudson resident, a writer for Vogue, former New York Times columnist. Pretty fancy guest we got there today, Ellen.
And now she's
a local yokel, like the rest
is,
of us.
She is.
And thank you so much for coming in.
Yes, Tamar. And please come back.
I will. Thank you both so much.
Oh, you're welcome.